The Mutual Broadcasting System presents STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. With today's briefing, here is retired Marine Intelligence Officer, Lieutenant Colonel Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, our Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. And I'm going to talk about something kind of goes back a bit, which is back to 1989 and the situation that we're seeing today and comparing it to what we saw back then. And I want to say before I go any further, I am not referring to anything involving Taylor Swift, just in case there's any doubts as where we're going on this. All right. In 1989, if I could take us to the Wayback Machine, by the way, if you understood what I said by Wayback Machine, you've already dated yourself. But in 1989, some enormous events took place. One, which didn't result in the overthrow of a totalitarian regime, which was the famous Tiananmen Square revolt that happened in China. And that's the People's Republic of China, Red China. And the fall of the Berlin Wall in Germany. And I can tell you, as someone who, a cold warrior, who was looking at what was happening, it was a stunning year. And I was actually stationed in the Far East, depending on what happened in Tiananmen Square, what was happening over in Beijing. There's a very good chance I could have got involved with doing some things over there regarding it, because we had a lot of U.S. citizens that were living in China at the time and still have a lot of U.S. citizens living in China. So long story short, it was a huge year. All right. First, let's talk about Tiananmen Square. Tiananmen Square was essentially a big protest movement led by a lot of students and a lot of workers. And in China, it's often known as the June 4th incident. And it was these protests were held in Tiananmen Square in Beijing, the famous, Imperial Square down there, from about 15 June until it was essentially crushed on, or 15 April until it was crushed on 4 June in 1989. There have been weeks of unsuccessful attempts between the demonstrators and Chinese government to find some sort of peaceful resolution of this issue, but the government eventually resorted to imposing martial law. In late May, they deployed troops into Beijing to essentially occupy the square on the night of 3 June, and that's what eventually led to what is referred to as the Tiananmen Square massacre that took place. The protests were initiated by the death of a former pro-reform Chinese Communist Party General Secretary, Xu Yaibang, in April of 1989. And also part of it was a response to the very rapid economic development and the huge societal changes, if you will, of post-Mao China. I don't know how I have any other way to describe what was going on there, but let's just say China was in a great state of flux. It was a huge shift from where it had been going literally since 1949. The movements reflected a lot of anxieties across the population and certainly a lot of anxieties within the political elites themselves about where the country was going. There were some common grievances at the time. They were concerned about, which is still a concern in China, corruption. Inflation was a big thing. Dismantling of what they called the, quote, Iron Rice Bowl, unquote. And also, a number of the students were very concerned that they weren't being prepared for this new economy. And the overall restriction of any participation in the political system that they had. So we ended up with about 1 million people basically gathered at Tiananmen Square. That's a lot of people. That's a huge protest thing that were taking place. And basically, during a 1 June meeting, the Communist Party leadership decided they were going to clear the square. And so Chinese troops advanced into central parts of Beijing. And in the early mornings of 4 June, they engaged in what were some extremely violent, bloody clashes with demonstrators attempting to block them. Many people were killed outright. A lot of people were injured. There was a famous story of the individual who stood in front of a tank that was advancing. However, at the end of the day, the tanks did advance. And so it was brutally repressed. Okay, so that's Tiananmen Square. You say, well, that wasn't very very enthralling. Essentially, the anti-communist folks were crushed. Well, it wasn't, it was interesting. Yes, but if you remember China during the 1990s and certainly going into the early 00s, it was a very different China. In fact, one of the reasons that that you see Taiwan not having all the defensive measures in place that one would expect was because they lulled themselves into thinking that the Chinese government had forever changed, that the that even though it was, quote, a communist government, that capitalism had prevailed across across China, and that it was just a matter of time, and eventually this communist government would transition into something else, where they thought that would become a multi-party democracy or something. Well, that's a discussion for another day. But they a lot of and it, within the United States, we saw it too. I mean, one of the things we basically brought China into the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and so. And that's something obviously that's being dealt with today too, as you see this off and on, you know, and some would say heavy-handed draconian imposition of tariffs in various different places, ways and stuff, that that is a response to this free trade thing that went like wildfire throughout the 1990s and into the O's. So okay, let's discuss the fall of the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall, or Berliner Mauer, was a guarded concrete barrier that basically encircled West Berlin from 1961 to 1989. And it separated East Berlin and German Democratic Republic, GDR, or East Germany, from West Berlin. West Berlin was, at the end of the war, Germany was partitioned into different segments. The segments that were under the Western countries, Britain, U.S., and France, became West Germany. And Berlin was segmented into different sectors. And the pro-Western sector of Berlin became West Berlin. And it was this bastion of freedom, if you will, that sat in the middle of East Germany. And there were some special quarters set up. Early on, the Soviet Union tried to blockade East Berlin or West Berlin, and that was the famous Berlin airlift that kept Berlin going during the blockade, as all the land routes to West Berlin were blocked by the Soviet Union and East German forces. And so it has kind of stood as a bastion of freedom, if you will, throughout the Cold War. It was out there. Well, anyway, there was this, in 61, they built this massive wall. Part of that was because Germans from the communist East were rushing into Berlin to get out of to get out from under communism. And they finally said, we need to put this big barrier to stop them from escaping East Germany. So hence the Berlin Wall. And, I think everyone kind of recognizes it. Surprisingly, for a lot of folks, it is kind of a historical marker, but it's not it's 2026 now. That's a long time ago. And so it's just not seen as what it was. But there were guard towers up there, concrete walls. There was a death strip that included landmines and all sorts of stuff. So anti-vehicle trenches, there were beds of nails to stop people. I mean, it was a really nasty piece of work, if you will, trying to stop people from escaping from East Germany and East Berlin. Now, the primary intent of the wall's construction was, as I just stated, but it became a defining symbol of human repression under communism and a defining symbol of what essentially was the failure of the communist economic system that was put in place by the Soviet Union. So if you go back, way back when, there was a famous speech by President Ronald Reagan in 1987, where he was literally at the Brandenburg Gate, which was the big gate that went into East Berlin. And he got up there, and in the middle of his speech, he said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." And basically challenging, you know, if communism really is all that, you know, Gorbachev was pretending it to be, right? Well, tear down this symbol of repression of communism. And many point back to that and say that was a defining moment. That was the beginning of the end. Of course, in 1987, we just thought it was pretty dramatic language that was being used by President Reagan. But basically, he was saying, hey, look, open up. If you think communism is really a system that has something going, then tear down this wall, open up the gate. And in 1989, there was a series of revolution in Eastern Bloc countries, Poland and Hungary in particular, and the events of what was sometimes called the Pan-European Picnic were set in motion, which basically led to largely the peaceful development during which the Iron Curtain basically fell apart, and the rulers of Eastern Europe, the Warsaw Pact countries, came under tremendous pressure to basically end their oppressive rule. And so that kind of gives you a little bit of a backdrop. And there were several weeks of civil unrest in East Germany. And on 9 November 1989, the East German government announced that all East German citizens could visit West Germany and West Berlin. And crowds in East German, crowds of East Germans crossed over into the West and climbed over the wall and eventually started taking pieces of the wall off. And there were people out there with sledgehammers, knocking off pieces of the wall and using it as collector's items, basically taking souvenirs of the wall for weeks. And eventually the wall pretty much fell apart. And that was the end of the Berlin Wall. So one would ask at this point, why this big history lesson, Hal? That's great. That's all interesting. But why is that important? Well, I'm going to point to the events of Iran, Cuba, and even Russia. Now, I have talked about Russia quite a bit. Russia is under severe economic strain. They are this deep strike campaign by Ukraine, wherein they're just sending these massive waves of 1,000 drones and missiles flying to various parts deep within Russia, taking out their primary source of income, which is oil, hitting oil refineries, but also taking out their distribution system, the Wildberries and Amazon distribution centers, which is kind of their versions of Amazon, if you will, which were completely legitimate, dual use. The government was using them for military purposes, military logistics, along with civilian. So it's not a war crime. Certainly Russia would claim that it was, but all of that stuff is having an enormous effect. You know, vast plumes of dark smoke are billowing over major cities to include St. Petersburg and Moscow. And the bottom line is, the war is being brought home to the Russian people. Their economy is in essentially a tailspin. The numbers are very difficult. In fact, it's very difficult to get real numbers out of Russia. You know, you hear something, there's a slight decline of 6% GDP or something like that. It's a lot of the academic institutions have a tough time trying to figure out what is the ground truth with the Russian economy. I mean, it's very difficult, but things are very bad. Long lines to get gas. Generally speaking, Russians being very pro-nationalist and used to deprivation, if you will, over the many decades, generations, they've kind of, they sort of take this pro-Russian nationalist thing. Of course, the other side is the great fear that if they say anything negative about what Putin's doing, that they could get the proverbial knock on the door at 3 o'clock in the morning. So, generally speaking, that's what you're seeing in Russia, but the economy is really a tailspin. And I would point out that when everything kind of fell apart in Russia, and certainly in 1991, but one would say, well, shoot, from 89 to 91, things were falling apart across the Warsaw Pact and elsewhere. And I would say that that's very instructive as to what was coming for the Soviet Union, that I think that, they also are sensing 1989, maybe a little bit later than 1989, if you put it in a Russian context, but there's a lot of discussion there. Now, let's the safe bet, the one that most are making in the beginning of 1989, was that there was frustration, anger, deep unrest and problems in these communist countries, but nobody really saw the events unfolding of 1989 quite the way they did. I'm sure there are some in the CIA who say, I saw this coming exactly the way it was. But I have to tell you, generally speaking, and I was part of the larger intelligence community back in 89, I don't think we really saw, the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union just completely falling apart over that year and the next 2 years. I mean, it was it really caught us by surprise as to how fast things unraveled. And when it hit that tipping point, that critical juncture, that's a good question. But I don't know anybody really thought the anti-communist protests in Eastern Europe and China would have such dramatic effect. In China, the protests were brutally repressed, as I mentioned. But the economic reform that did come out of that, and what many would point back and say that they, even though they repressed the protests themselves in the most brutal authoritarian fashion, they were forced into really changing things, making a little bit more broader opportunity for Chinese people across the board. And, and China eventually developed into, still a communist government, but there was a lot of huge capitalist reforms. You know, a lot of billionaires were created in China. A lot of offshoring occurred of manufacturing still there in China. So de jure communist government, but one would say a de facto capitalist system in many ways. In Eastern Europe, they eventually threw off the yoke of communist rule altogether. The Warsaw Pact eventually collapsed. And in December of 1989, the Soviet Union itself actually collapsed 2 years after the Berlin Wall fell. So the Cold War essentially was over. A lot of people thought, well, that's great. Capitalism and liberal democracy is going to flourish around the world. And for that, certainly in the decade of the 90s, we kind of felt that was where it was going. Now, Cuba has always been something of an anachronism, ruled by Fidel and Raul Castro since 1959. And if you were to describe the Cuban economy, I think the term not much would come to mind. It has survived during the Cold War largely on the largesse of the Soviet Union, and then later Russia helped it, to some extent China. But under Chavez and Maduro governments in Venezuela, there was a economic, and by that I really mean oil, lifeline that was provided to Cuba that kind of kept it afloat and kept their economy going. There were changes. The U.S. did actually normalize relations eventually with Cuba. There was tourism that was happening in Cuba, bringing in some hard capital. However, you still had this brutally repressive regime led by the Castro brothers. And now that Venezuela lifeline's gone, there's really not much that Russia can do to help them. And China's kind of standing back. They recognize that, I think they're just looking at geography, if nothing else. I mean, Cuba is really difficult for them to do much. I mean, first off, it's on the other side. It's not a Pacific country, so there is no direct way to actually help Cuba unless they send, if you want to send aid, it's got ships that have to go, pretty much around Africa through the Indian Ocean, Pacific, Indian Ocean, and Atlantic Ocean in order to get there. Or you try and send it across Pacific, and then it's either got to go through the Panama Canal, which is, largely the U.S. has greater control there, or down around South America, very tough area of water. But nonetheless, it's not something they can readily support, regardless of their intent to help them out. And there's a lack of power within Cuba. With a lack of power, you also have problems with fresh water, with sewage, all sorts of stuff. You have essentials for human survival. They're in short supply. And the regime is still clinging to power, but there's banging of pots and protests every night there. And our embargo and sanctions are set in place to essentially trigger an economic collapse. A lot of folks thought that would happen sometime in summer, around August, that they were going to run out of steam. It is really a debate as to what is keeping the Cuban regime in power right now. But that noose around the neck, their economic neck, keeps tightening and tightening. So eventually, something amazing happens. It's the economy will effectively, some would say it's already collapsed. It's just not quite clear why people haven't really gone to the streets to take on the political side to basically ensure regime collapse. Although I would point out they have a brutally repressive, police state there. And so I'm sure a lot of people are very concerned in the old-fashioned way as to why they don't want to go out there and protest and too vigorously, unless they get that knock on the door or something else happens to them on the street. In Iran, it's been ruled by this brutally repressive government, theocratic autocracy since 79. The war, our embargo, our sanctions are all having a huge effect. And again, we're trying to trigger economic collapse with that regime collapse. Our stated reason for the war was to end their ability to create nuclear weapons, but our energy secretary basically says, well, we don't think we're going to get an agreement in place to do that, to which I listened to what he said, and I'm kind of wondering if he was implying at the end of that, I was like, well, it's just difficult, and we've caused tremendous damage. And it kind of sounded like we're either going to, throw in the towel on trying to do something to stop them from getting nuclear weapons or declare victory in that with what we've done and then walk away. Or if maybe it was setting up that, you know, the only way we can achieve victory is a regime change, and that is via economic collapse that triggers regime collapse, and that's where it's going. But don't forget the, you know, the protests, the economically driven protests the last December, January, resulted in the government killing about 40 to 50,000 people. It's not just the number of protesters were killed. It's also the composition of those who were killed and those who were imprisoned, taking a lot of the, if you will, the leadership guts out of that protest anti-regime movement. And it's very clear that that's something that they're having a tough time recovering from in terms of going after the regime now. Now, the U.S. and Israel began its operations in late February. It was projected to last 4 to 6 weeks. It's now going past its 6 month. That is having huge political import within the U.S. in the midterms. But I would point out that I've seen estimates that about 60% of the gross domestic product of Iran has been basically eviscerated by the combination of the military strikes and everything else that's being done. And reports are abounding of, you know, just uncontrolled inflation, lack of basic items on the shelves. Yes, they have a very robust black market economy that does move stuff around, but it's very difficult to get stuff in and pretty much impossible to get anything out of there. So they're not exporting oil. They don't have that revenue coming in. They've already run out of money to pay for the professors in the universities. The professors in the universities are now going on strike. If the professors go on strike in the universities, that will usually trigger things like student unrest. And when the students become restive, they tend to go out and protest a lot. And when the students protest, then it leads to the seeds of a larger protest movement. So I do see things kind of happening. And when they run out of money to pay for the Revolutionary Guard Corps members and the besieged militia, I could see things happening even faster. But they have, I don't know if they've quite hit that point yet. So now one pillar that the regime had was basically blocking the Strait of Hormuz, basically putting a stranglehold on oil and everything else coming out of the strait. But now it's appearing that that is shifting, that there is a lot of oil coming out of the strait. I've heard estimates that we're getting close to 2/3 the amount of oil coming out of the strait as before the strait. Now, a lot of this, the numbers are a little kind of, it's not clear to me when they're talking about that, if they're talking just about the strait or oil coming out of the Middle East. And a lot of that is the surge increase in oil going through pipelines, one the East-West pipeline across Saudi Arabia, the other going down to Fujairah in the UAE, which bypasses the strait. I don't know if that's not included in that total number. And it sounds like that may be of the amount of oil coming out. But nonetheless, a lot more capability getting that going. So the question is, will all this economic strangulation of Cuba, Iran, what's happening in Russia, will this produce results? And yes, there is growing dissatisfaction in the U.S., certainly a dissatisfaction amongst a lot of our allies around the world with our current policy with Iran, probably less so with Cuba, but certainly some. But the forces that maintain the status quo in both Cuba and Iran are considerable, but so are the forces that pretend change. Kind of reminds me a lot of 1989. And you know, I don't know that we saw that the Soviet Union would completely collapse and go away, but it did. And Ukrainian deep strikes are having a huge impact in Russia. And I don't know when that trigger point will be. In fact, for many of us looking at Russia and the war there and everything that's happened, we kind of think, we thought that things would show up first. I think what's happened in Russia is, and certainly every indication there is that they've been really behind the scenes, brutally repressing anything out there, using all the technology that's available to find anyone who's dissatisfied with the government early on and shut them down. And so that's part of why, but the latent dissatisfaction with what's happening in Russia is certainly all there. So I would say the same with Iran, the same with a Cuban society. So whereas, you know, a lot of people say, well, it'll never happen, I would say, I would kind of go back to that famous saying, quote, dictators are rulers who always look good until the last 10 minutes, unquote. And that's kind of what I'm thinking of here. And the question is, are we getting close to that last 10 minutes? So a lot of times they go, well, this won't happen. It's optimistic thinking to think that this will occur. But I will say this, it did happen in 1989. I was there. I saw it firsthand. It was dramatic. It was, you know, it was everything that certainly Ronald Reagan wanted to see happen, but it was a massive shift And it was a massive shift that took place, not just in 89, but going over the next couple of years. And we're still dealing with the aftermath of what happened then. So it did happen. So remember the other 1989. Nothing to do with Taylor Swift again. Remember what happened politically across the globe in 89. There are a lot of things in play. So anyway, thanks for listening to Strat. Thanks for taking the time. Please tune in next time. Go to stratpodcast.com if you haven't. Also, you can go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kiffer TV. See all my appearances on various different networks, media all over the world. And you can always go to the corporate website for Global Risk Intelligent Planning, www.gripsa or gripsa.com. And certainly you can hear more about my assessments of what's happening around the world with various different things, dealing with conflicts, wars, and a variety of other things changing our world and our society. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.
Strategic Risk Assessment Talk is presented by the Mutual Broadcasting System. Stay informed on the matters we discuss by visiting stratpodcast.com and other sites mentioned by Hal Kiffer. You may interact with the show through our website at stratpodcast.com or through our Facebook social media site. Thank you for joining us.